Some of this stuff you might be familiar with, what I'm going to be speaking about this afternoon, but we wanted to give you some content just about the evidence for God, about kind of material you can draw on, just to kind of give you a more rounded picture of the reasons for our faith and some of the answers to difficult questions, particularly about the Bible and about science, which is what we'll be doing this afternoon. So my name is Callum Miller. I'm also working at the Zacharias Trust with Alex. I also work part-time as a medical doctor and also as a philosopher and ethicist in Oxford. So do a little bit of these kind of questions as part of my job, in fact. But today, like I said, we're going to talk a little bit about the historical evidence for the New Testament. And this is going to be a talk that I actually wrote with another colleague of ours from the Zacharias Trust, who's not here today, called Max Baker-Heitch, who's one of the kind of philosophers at the Zacharias Trust. And we've been working a lot on the historical reliability of the New Testament and have found actually it's something that we can have great confidence in and something that we can really trust as Christians, and that's something that actually when we look into the history, we find that it actually enlivens our faith to some extent. And so I've been on a few trips to Israel where you can see a lot of the archaeology, you can see a lot of the sites that Jesus would have been. And some of the times those are just completely made up, and that's completely honest. Some of the places in Israel where they say Jesus was, it's just a complete guess. But actually, a lot of the times we see things in Israel and you look at the archaeology, archaeologists do actually think that this is where the Bible was talking about, and we'll see a few examples of those. But going to Israel and seeing the history and seeing how actually God isn't just an abstract concept, God actually came into history and came into a concrete time and place that we can even visit, is actually really quite empowering. So we're going to be talking about a little bit of that evidence. One of the kind of impressions we can get from people who speak about the Bible and who speak about whether it's trustworthy is the kind of idea that the Bible essentially is only trustworthy as a book of faith. It's only trustworthy as scripture, and it has no real kind of reliable history to it. And so you get people like Christopher Hitchens, for example, saying the contradictions and illiteracies of the New Testament have filled up many books by eminent scholars and have never been explained by any Christian authority except in the feeblest terms of metaphor and a Christ of faith. And the French writer Michel Onfray says, Jesus' existence has not been historically established. No contemporary documentation of the event, no archaeological proof, nothing certain exists today. And that's the impression we can often get from conversations or from the media, as if there's sort of a scholarly debate about this, or even as if most scholars don't think Jesus existed. But the reality in New Testament studies, which I've worked in, is actually very, very different. So E.P. Sanders, who's by no means a kind of conservative scholar, he doubts many parts of the New Testament and is not just kind of a conservative evangelical scholar. He kind of represents the mainstream of scholarship about the historical Jesus. And actually, he says what most historians think about Jesus, which is that there are no substantial doubts about the general course of Jesus's life. And he gives a list of many other things that scholars pretty much all accept are true of the historical Jesus. It's a long list that I'm not going to go through, but it includes things like he was born at a certain time in 4 BC, near the time of the death of Herod the Great. He was from Nazareth. He knew John the Baptist. He preached. He went to Jerusalem for the Passover. He was executed by the Roman authorities under Pontius Pilate, and so on. And there are a number of facts that virtually all historians, whether Christian or not, accept about the historical Jesus. Before we kind of get into that and look at the evidence for the gospel authors writing reliable history in the first place, there's a kind of initial question of, well, even if the gospel writers wrote something that was reliable in the first place, hasn't it been changed since then? Hasn't the Bible been changed and there are lots of textual variants? And over 2,000 years, surely the Bible has changed and it kind of gets mutated in a Chinese whisper sort of fashion. Well, actually, the way scholars address this question when it comes to any historical document is to look at the manuscripts we have and to see how well would they match up with each other, how many of them there are, where they're from, and questions like that. And when they look at these, that helps to see, actually, if there are lots and lots of manuscripts and they all say basically the same thing and they're from a wide range geographically, then probably the manuscripts we have today represent what the original documents wrote. And actually, when we look at it in these terms, which is the way scholars look at whether we have a reliable copy of the manuscript, because we don't have the original documents of the New Testament, The New Testament actually far surpasses any other ancient document. That's actually quite an incredible claim and an incredible fact, that the New Testament, when it comes to the reliability of the transmission and the number of manuscripts we have, far surpasses any other ancient historical manuscript. And this is no exaggeration. So take, just as a simple comparison, the Annals of Imperial Rome, which was written by Tacitus, an early second century Roman historian, who's in fact widely regarded as the greatest historian of Imperial Rome. And actually, a lot of our knowledge of Rome comes from Tacitus, and he's regarded as one of the kind of central Roman historians in history. And this is one of his major works, the Annals. Now, when it comes to the Annals, we base all our knowledge of what Tacitus originally wrote on just two manuscripts. These are manuscripts from the medieval period, from the Middle Ages, perhaps nearly 1,000 years after they were initially written. And there's only two of them, and each of these manuscripts only has part of the Annals. So there's actually hardly anything in the Annals which is corroborated by even two manuscripts. We only have two partial manuscripts for this book. And yet Roman historians have the utmost confidence believing that everything in there is pretty much what Tacitus wrote, give or take a few minor errors. Contrast with this with the New Testament, where partial copies, which are not just kind of small pages, partial copies can mean the four Gospels in their entirety or Paul's letters in their entirety. So these are very substantial documents. We have 340 manuscripts of these in the Greek and more in the Latin. We have four complete copies of the entire New Testament from just within a couple of centuries after the New Testament, and many more Latin and other language manuscripts. And then when it comes to fragments, which are smaller bits, perhaps a page long or sometimes just a few words, we have literally thousands. And it's something like 5,000 Greek manuscripts, 24,000 manuscripts in other languages. Now, to some extent, this might not seem like very many. If there's only four complete copies of the New Testament, that doesn't seem like very many. But that's actually much more than we have for most historical manuscripts, where, for example, in the Annals, we don't have any complete copies. We're just going on kind of partial copies. But historians trust that what we have in the Annals is what Tacitus originally wrote. And given the sheer number of copies we have in the Greek alone, let alone in other languages where we have many, many thousands more, historians are confident that what is in the New Testament that we have was originally what was written, and that's a consensus judgment among historians. But that leaves us with the question of, well, did the original historians, did the original gospel authors record accurate history in the first place? Granted, we can accept, along with pretty much every historian, that it hasn't changed significantly in that time. Maybe the historians, the gospel authors, didn't write accurate history in the first place. Well, we can actually look at this historically from a historian's perspective and see that the gospel authors did get things right. Sometimes we can check them against external sources, whether against other documents from the time or against archaeological data. And sometimes we can see hints within the text itself that suggests that the gospel authors aren't just making things up, that they're being honest. And we'll get to that in a moment. But this is a way that we've come up with which is quite intuitive and helpful for seeing just how we can compare the New Testament with other sources to verify its accuracy as a historical record. And it kind of proceeds from more general facts about the world of the New Testament to more specific facts. And it does it like this. It says, firstly, the world depicted by the New Testament is real. And what we mean by that is just that the general outline, the general picture of first century Israel as depicted in the New Testament is accurate according to other historical sources that we have. So the New Testament gets things right about the geography of Israel, about the geography of the rest of the Mediterranean. It gets things right about the political atmosphere. It gets things right about the religious atmosphere and about particular social customs. And we can give a few examples of that. But even if you set a book kind of in a real world, there might be a story that is completely made up. So, for example, the story of Harry Potter is based on a real world with a station, King's Cross Station, and indeed now a platform 9 3/4 that they've installed there. But nevertheless, the story is completely made up and the characters are made up. But what we can see when we look at the New Testament is that the characters are real as well. So the major figures, the kind of famous political figures mentioned in the New Testament, are all corroborated by external sources. And even when it comes to the minor characters who we can't find in alternative sources because they weren't famous, we can show signs that they were probably real people and that the New Testament matches up with reality. But again, you can have a world that is real and a kind of general setting that is real, and you can even have real characters and just make up stories about them. But again, we're going to say that if we look at the external evidence in the archaeology, the main events are real. We can confirm the main events of Jesus' life and the early church just from looking at non-Christian sources alone, early non-Christian sources. And then finally, we look at some more kind of intricate details. What about those times we can't verify against external records? For pretty much every event in history, we have either no historical records or we have only one historical record. And I'm talking about ancient history. So it's not uncommon for us to only have one record of an event. Now, how can we tell whether we should trust the record of that event? We can trust the general reliability of the author who wrote about them by comparing them in the cases where more than one people writes about the event. Or we can look at signs within the document itself that it's telling the truth. And we're going to give some of those signs last as well. So let's start with kind of a general kind of thought experiment. So this is the city of New York City in the United States of America. And this kind of shows how it's changed over time. And you can see that actually the landscape, the buildings in particular, has changed dramatically over the last 100 years or so. Now, suppose that you were writing nowadays about New York 100 years ago when it was very different. If you wanted to write accurately about New York 100 years ago, you would have to have good information about New York 100 years ago. You would have to either have been to New York 100 years ago or spoken to people who were there 100 years ago who could tell you about it. Or you would have to rely on accurate archaeology or accurate encyclopedias or accurate sources of information on the internet, for example. Now, they didn't have some of these sources in the first century. But the point is that if you're going to write about a fairly distant time and place, or if you're going to write about any time and place at all, the only way you can get it right time and time again is by having access to accurate information, whether that's from going there yourself and seeing the events or speaking to people who reliably tell you about the events. And we're going to argue that the Gospels do one of those two things. Either they were written by people who saw the events themselves and who were in a position to know that they were real, or they were written by people who spoke to eyewitnesses of the events, who gave them accurate information. Either way, the information is going to be accurate, and we can see this because we can compare what the New Testament says against what the other sources say and against what the archaeology says. But it's all the more impressive, actually, if between the time of the events and between the time of writing, the city is completely destroyed. So if New York between 100 years ago and now was completely destroyed and every trace of everything 100 years ago was wiped out, it makes it all the more impressive if you writing about it today get things right. It means you have to have really accurate memories. It means you can't just go to New York and make guesses based on what you see there. You have to have really accurate memories of what you saw or what other people that you knew saw. And this is, in fact, the reality of first century Jerusalem, because near the end of the first century, Jerusalem was entirely destroyed by the Romans. The temple was destroyed. All the kind of city was completely pillaged and ravaged. And because the Gospels are widely held to have been written after this event, it's all the more impressive if the Gospel writers get information right about Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, because they couldn't just go to Jerusalem in 80 AD and look at Jerusalem and look at how things worked and guess what it was like 50 years ago, because the city had completely changed, the people had completely changed, the religious authorities and the religious structures and customs had completely changed, everything completely changed. So the only way the gospel authors could write accurately about the early first century Israel and Jerusalem is by having been there themselves or having spoken to reliable sources of information who were there in the first century. So the first category we're going to talk about is places, and we're going to focus particularly on the Gospel of John. Now, in New Testament scholarship, John has traditionally been seen as the least reliable historically of all the Gospels, partly because he's thought to have written his Gospel later than the other Gospels, partly because he talks of Jesus in very elevated spiritual terms, which some scholars have said this means that it was a later developed theology that John must have written many decades after, because it takes time for that theology to develop, because it talks about Jesus in such clear divine spiritual terms. And so for that reason, many historians in history have actually said the Gospel of John is almost historically worthless. But in fact, archaeology has completely changed this picture of the Gospel of John. And most archaeologists now would say that our picture of the Gospel of John has been completely revolutionized by the findings of archaeology. And archaeology has proved that virtually every place mentioned in the Gospel of John was a real place that actually we can look at and we can verify details in the Gospel of John. So as an example, this is the Pool of Bethesda, which was a pool that John mentions in chapter 5, where a healing takes place. It says, in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate, there's a pool called in Hebrew Bethesda, which has 5 porticos. And porticos are just arches at the pool. And that was unusual. Most of these pools would have had 4, one for each side. So scholars said, well, this place clearly didn't exist. It's clearly a made-up place. And the 5 arches is just symbolic because it means it's talking about the 5 books of the Mosaic Law, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So it's all symbolic. And the person sitting under the porches who Jesus healed was just sitting under the law in the sense that he was under the Mosaic law and didn't understand grace and wasn't kind of prepared for Jesus. He was under the law and under the condemnation of the law. It's all entirely symbolic. And that's what scholars used to say. But the problem with this is about 60 years ago, we found the Pool of Bethesda, and you can go and visit it today. So this is a photo I actually took in Jerusalem of the Pool of Bethesda. And they, in fact, found that it had 5 walls, which, as I said, was unusual at the time. So it confirmed not only that the place existed, but also that the detail John talks about, which scholars dismissed as crazy, was actually a detail that has been shown to be probably true by archaeology, because it found a 5th wall where a portico would have been. Another example is Capernaum, which is a town in Galilee, just right next to the Sea of Galilee, up in northern Israel. And this is Robert Price, who is not a kind of professional historian at a major university, but nevertheless has written a lot of books on the history of Jesus and is a very skeptical scholar. And he says there's a major collision between the gospel tradition and archaeology concerning the existence of synagogues and Pharisees in pre-70 Galilee. So what he's saying is there weren't synagogues and Pharisees in Galilee before 70 AD, which is when the temple was destroyed. And so he says the Gospels are wrong because it says the Gospels say that Jesus preached in synagogues in Galilee. Well, again, the problem is that archaeology has shown him to be probably wrong, because if you go to Capernaum today, you find not only that the town existed and that it bears several marks and details that suggest the Gospels are accurate, but also we found a synagogue from the first century in Capernaum, which might well be from before 70 AD. And even if the one in Capernaum isn't from before then, we found other synagogues in Galilee which are from earlier. And so we know now that there were synagogues in first century Galilee. And again, scholars used to say this was crazy and the Gospels just got it wrong. But archaeology has shown that they've got it right. What we've also found in Capernaum is a few other things. We found that there are Roman remains. Now, this is not necessarily usual for a small town in Galilee, because most towns in Galilee at the time were Jewish, and you wouldn't just put Romans and a Roman garrison or Roman centurions in any old town in Galilee. And the Gospels record that there's a centurion in Capernaum. So again, you might think the Gospels have got it wrong. But actually, again, what scholars have found and archaeologists have found in Capernaum is that there are Roman remains specifically in Capernaum, which fits perfectly with what the Gospels say when they say that there was a Roman centurion in Capernaum. I don't have time to talk about it now, but there's a couple of other things that archaeologists have found which, again, verify what the Gospels say. And one of these is actually that archaeologists are quite confident now that they've actually found Simon Peter's house in Capernaum where Jesus would have stayed and where Jesus would have healed Peter's mother-in-law. And this is a quite mainstream judgment by historians all across the kind of religious spectrum that actually we probably have found Simon Peter's house there. And you can go and see that today. So this is it just here. It was later turned into a house church at a very early date, and that's one of the reasons scholars think it was likely his house. A further example is Nazareth, and some of you might have come across this idea that Nazareth just didn't exist at the time. Nazareth didn't exist in first century Israel. So this isn't a scholarly website, but it's a website called JesusNeverExisted.com, which is how you can tell it's probably not a scholarly one. But it does say Nazareth is not mentioned in the entire Old Testament. The Talmud, a Jewish book from about 200 or 400 AD, says it doesn't say anything about Nazareth. St. Paul doesn't mention Nazareth. No ancient historian or geographer mentions Nazareth at all. None of this would matter, of course, if, like the nearby pagan city of Sepphoris, we could stroll through the remains of first century bathhouses, villas, theaters, and stuff. Yet no such ruins in Nazareth exist. We don't have ruins from first century Nazareth. Well, again, the problem with this is that we do have ruins from first century Nazareth, and these are some of them. This is a tomb. You can see the kind of shaft in the bottom there and a rolling stone just at the side. It doesn't come out very well. But this is the kind of tomb that Jesus perhaps would have been buried in, at least with the rolling stone. And this has been dated to the first century in Nazareth. And again, you can go and see this if you go to Nazareth today. Another example, a final one for the moment in terms of places, is the Pool of Siloam. Again, scholars might have thought this didn't exist. The Pool of Siloam means the pool sent, and scholars say, well, Jesus sent a blind man to wash there, so the pool is just symbolic because Jesus sent him there, and that's what the pool means. But again, scholars have found that the Pool of Siloam actually exists. This is a picture of a 4th century pool which was built nearby. The actual Pool of Siloam has been discovered just a few years ago and is about 100 meters away from this one. But again, even recently, even in the last few years, we're finding material which confirms what the Bible says. Finally, again, I won't have time to go into this in detail, but we have what is likely the place where Jesus was buried. And again, this is a sober historical judgment by mainstream archaeologists. So I can't remember if he's at Princeton or Yale, but the eminent archaeologist and scholar James Charlesworth says that most scholars today are agreed that Golgotha, which is now a church in the middle of Jerusalem, is probably where Jesus was actually buried. And there's a number of reasons scholars think this, which again, I won't go into. But it's a mainstream judgment that we probably have the very place Jesus was buried, now in the center of Jerusalem, but at the time it was outside of Jerusalem. And recent discoveries have shown that this is likely the place. So that's a little bit about the places, and it's worth saying that pretty much everywhere in the Gospel of John, which historians have said was the least reliable of all the Gospels, pretty much every place in the Gospel of John has now been found and has confirmed details of what John actually says about them. Well, what about the political landscape and the religious landscape and the social customs of the time? Well, when we look at the politics, we find again that the New Testament goes into quite a lot of detail. And you might think if it goes into a lot of detail, it would slip up. It would get some details wrong. But actually, when we look and we compare it with other records from the time and with archaeology from the time, we find that even the very intricate details, even the small distinguishing marks that the New Testament puts in, gets the kind of the situation and the reality accurate and right every single time. As just one example of this kind of intricate detail, Luke, when he writes the Gospel of Luke and when he wrote the Gospel of Acts, spoke about a lot of different political leaders. Particularly in the book of Acts, he went all over the Mediterranean, or he describes Paul going all over the Mediterranean, going to places like Ephesus or Thessalonica or Malta or Cyprus. And in every single place, he mentions who Paul speaks to. And he says Paul speaks to the town clerk or to the chief man or to the scribe or to the governor and so on. He uses slightly different terms in each place. And actually, this isn't just a coincidence, and this isn't just kind of literary variation that Luke is trying to aim for. He's actually remembering exactly what the leader was called in every single place that he went to, and historians have shown that Luke was getting it right every single time. So for example, in Cyprus, he says the governor was called the Antipatos. Sorry, I can't actually read because of the light. The magistrates of Philippi were called strategoi, meaning kind of governor or strategist. Those of Thessalonica were called politarchi, meaning kind of political rulers. And the chief executive magistrate in Ephesus is a grammateus, meaning a town clerk. So Luke goes through the entire Mediterranean, and he doesn't just have an encyclopedia where he learns what the rulers of each place were called. Those kind of things didn't exist readily for these kind of writers. But because he either went on the journeys with Paul, or because he spoke to Paul and got accurate information that has been preserved accurately, in every single instance, he's got these details right. And we can check those against history. So this is just a normal classical historian. He's not a kind of Christian scholar, not a New Testament historian. He's just a historian of Roman society. And he says, for the book of Acts, the confirmation of historicity, i.e. historical reliability, is overwhelming. Any attempt to reject its basic historicity, even in matters of detail, must now appear absurd. And he concludes, Roman historians have long taken it for granted. This kind of skeptical attitude about the New Testament is not an attitude that's shared among Roman historians or Greek historians. The actual basic historical reliability of the book of Acts is just taken for granted by those historians. Likewise, some of the customs at the time have been verified. Now, one of the objections to the argument for Jesus' resurrection says, well, maybe Jesus' tomb was found empty because he was buried in a different place. Maybe he wasn't buried properly in a tomb at all. He was just thrown into a ditch. And they say, well, actually, this is likely because at the time, criminals were just thrown into ditches and they would never have been given a burial in a tomb. Well, actually, again, if we look at the contemporary documents from the time, if we look at the historians and the Jewish writers at the time, and if we look at archaeology, we can find that this is simply wrong, that criminals were buried just as well as ordinary people. So, for example, Josephus, the kind of eminent first century Jewish historian, says, the Jews are so careful about burial rites that even malefactors, i.e. wrongdoers or criminals, who have been sentenced to crucifixion are taken down and buried before sunset. And in fact, we have archaeological evidence of this. Just a few decades ago, we found the evidence of a crucifixion victim. Now, normally we wouldn't recognize these because crucifixion victims were often tied to the crosses rather than nailed, in which case they would leave no archaeological evidence, or they would take the nails out of the victim for burial. So normally you can't see whether someone who has been buried and you find their skeleton has been crucified. But in this case, the nail got lodged in their ankle bone. And so archaeologists looking around tombs in Jerusalem have found a crucifixion victim who still had the nail in their ankle bone, who had been given a proper burial. So when the Gospels say that Jesus was given a proper burial, they're not just making it up, they're not making a mistake. When criminals would normally not be buried, they're actually perfectly in line with what we find in history. As another example, the author of the Gospel of Mark, who probably knew Simon Peter, he talks about when Sadducees come to Jesus. And the Gospel of Mark says that when Sadducees came to Jesus, they kind of mocked him about Jesus' belief in the resurrection because Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. And Jesus has a very strange answer, because there are lots of things in the Old Testament that kind of hint at resurrection more clearly. In the book of Ezekiel, it talks about the valley of dry bones. In the book of Daniel, it talks about resurrection. And Jesus could have just proved his belief in the resurrection from those books. He could have just said, well, look here, in the Hebrew scriptures, resurrection is very clear. But instead, he goes for a quite strange passage, which doesn't really talk about resurrection at all. He goes for something in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the law. And he says, God spoke to, who's he speaking to? I think he's speaking to Moses at this point. And he says, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And Jesus says, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living. And this is a very strange passage to go to prove the resurrection when you have all sorts of other books in the Old Testament that show that resurrection was a reality of Jewish theology. But the reason Jesus does this, and it's not emphasized in Mark, it's not something that Mark is saying, look, I know all this information. Mark just casually mentions this, and what he actually does is casually reflect the reality of the situation. Because Sadducees, we learn in Josephus, and in other works, didn't believe in the resurrection. So Mark gets that right. He gets the Sadducees' belief right. But he also gets something else right, which is that the Sadducees only believed the authoritative books in the Hebrew Bible were the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. I switched the order around there. This is interesting because Mark, again, doesn't labor the point. He doesn't say, look how clever I am. Look, I've read this information and I'm trying to create something that's believable. He just mentions it as a matter of fact that Jesus appealed to the first five books of the Bible. And so Mark just casually reflects his knowledge of what the Sadducees believed without making a big fuss of it. And this is something that historians think actually shows Mark was just aware of the reality of pre-70 Jerusalem and pre-70 Jewish theology. So again, Mark gets his information historically accurate. Finally, in terms of looking at the world, the kind of social landscape and the religious landscape, scholars have often doubted that Galilee was particularly Jewish at Jesus' time, and they say the Gospels are wrong because they present Galilee as a Jewish place and they present Jesus from Galilee as a Jewish person. But they say Galilee wasn't at that time very Jewish. When the northern kind of kingdom of Israel had been taken over by the Assyrians in the 8th century BC, the Jews never resettled that area. And so they say Galilee never became Jewish again. It was always kind of Hellenistic or Greek or Roman after that time. And so when the Gospels portray Galilee as Jewish, they're getting it wrong. But again, what we've seen in archaeology time and time again in sites all over Galilee is that actually the Bible has got things right, that Galilee was Jewish at this time, and it was very, very Jewish. And they know this because if you go to the sites, they show clear signs that there was a Jewish population living there and that the main population of the site was Jewish. Signs of this would include a lack of pig bones, which you would find in Greek cities because they ate pigs in Greek cities, but you didn't eat them or find the bones in Jewish cities. They found large stone pots, and these are interesting because it was only the Jews who used these sort of stone pots because they were very heavy. Everyone else thought they were pointlessly heavy and they didn't have any need for them, so they made much lighter vessels for water and for carrying things around in. But according to Jewish purity laws, it was much easier to keep things purer in these stone pots. So they went to the effort of using these very heavy stone pots to keep in conformity with their purity laws. And that is what scholars have found in Galilee. They found that they used these cumbersome pots, which were only used by the Jewish people because they were cumbersome, but because they conformed to Jewish law much more easily. And so scholars have now proved, essentially, that Galilee was an extremely Jewish area at the time, contrary to the assertions of skeptical scholars before that. Now, what about the characters? We've seen quite comprehensively, and there's much more that could be said about the world of the New Testament, but scholars seem to agree now that the world of the New Testament, the geography, the landscape, seems to have been accurately represented. Well, what about the characters? Are they real? When it comes to the main characters in the New Testament, the ones who we would expect to find in other sources, we find that they are mentioned in other sources. And the information we have in those other sources lines up perfectly with what the New Testament says. So in the New Testament, we read of Jesus, of course, we read of John the Baptist, we read of the Herod family, the whole royal family of Herodian kings around Israel, Caiaphas, the high priest at the time, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea at the time, and James, the brother of Jesus. Some of these weren't even famous, and we're almost in a sense lucky to have sources outside the Bible confirming them. But actually, that's exactly what we have. So when it comes to Jesus, we have a number of sources outside the Bible which confirm his existence and confirm the general facts of his life. But we also have sources which say that all these other people existed, everyone who you would expect to find in other sources, and it represents them in much the same way as we find in the Gospels. We don't have time to get into that now, but take my word for it. And if you want to ask more about it later, then I'm very happy to go into more detail. So just as a kind of an example, this is Bart Ehrman. This is a skeptical atheist New Testament historian, isn't sympathetic to Christianity at all, and he says no serious historian doubts the existence of Jesus. We have more evidence for Jesus than for almost anyone of his time period. And this is an atheist historian speaking and saying this. We have a colleague who sometimes works with us at the Zacharias Trust, who's a classic scholar, John Dixon, and he set a task. He said, if you can, he said it to kind of the atheist groups in Australia where he's from. He said, if you can find any historian, any professional historian of classics, of ancient history, of New Testament history, anywhere in the modern world, in a kind of mainstream secular position at a secular university, who doesn't believe in Jesus, I will eat a page of my Bible. And they're still looking several years later. They can't find a single scholar who doubts the existence of Jesus. But when it comes to the minor characters, the ones who weren't famous and the ones who aren't mentioned in other sources, and we would never expect them to be, we find actually there's a really clever way that's only come about in the last few years of showing that these minor characters were real people, and that the New Testament is probably talking about real people when it mentions them. So these are people like Mary, the mother of Jesus, or Martha, or Bartimaeus, all these sorts of people who you would never expect to find in other sources. What we find is that their names actually match up perfectly with the general proportion of names in the period and at the place. So in first century Palestine or first century Israel, we can look at which names were common, at which names were not common, and we see that the Bible actually uses the common names and it doesn't use kind of uncommon names. Now, the reason this is interesting is because you could never just guess this by chance, and I'm going to show you now that this is the case. We've mostly been in England in 1997, or since 1997, and so we have a good sense of which kind of names are common here. We could probably guess which are some of the most common names, certainly. So if you were to guess the top five most popular English baby boys' names in 1997, those are people who are about 22 years old now, 21, 22. What would you think the most common names are? Does anyone want to suggest any? William? Harry, James? Sam, Jacob, Muhammad. So I think you got one or two. But as you can see, it's actually quite difficult to do, even for people who have been in England for the last 22 years. The most common names are Jack first, Thomas second, James third, Joshua fourth, and Daniel fifth. That's hard for us to get right, in order especially, even having lived in England for the last 20 years and having met many of these people, having named some of these people, I assume. It's much harder if you go to the other side of the continent and try to name the top five most popular Romanian baby boy names from the year 2000, so about 18 or 19 now. Does anyone want to have a guess? Robin. Dragan. Bogdan. Vlad. I know some of these names are in Romania, but they're actually not the most common by any means. They're Andrei, David, Alexandru, Gabriel, and Mihai. Now, these names are ones that, in a sense, we should recognize. They're all names that we use in the English form. It's just Andrew, David, Alexander, Gabriel, and Michael. So these are familiar enough names, but we would never guess which of them were the most popular and the most common the other side of Europe, even in our time. Now, if you think you were writing in the end of the first century about the early first century Israel, and you were trying to create a realistic story, there's no way you could just guess the most accurate or most common names that came up in that story. There's no way that the people you invented for your story would have the exact same proportion of those common names that actually existed at the time. And there's no way you could look at a census or look at an encyclopedia in order to do that. That's not the kind of thing the gospel authors were doing. And yet what we find is that the gospel authors, because they really saw the events and because they're talking about real people, just by accident, without design, they managed to get this information right because they're writing about reality. And we can see this by looking at all the names that were used in the first century. And we can do this by going to Palestine and looking at tombs and looking at other inscriptions, because lots of tombs would name the person who was buried there. They would name the family members of people who were buried there. And all sorts of inscriptions around the country would give names. And we can see which of these are most common, in exactly what proportion these names occur. And when we do that, we find that the Gospels represent that perfectly, or pretty much perfectly. Not so perfectly as to arouse suspicion, but nevertheless, with extreme kind of similarity to the actual proportion of names around the country. So for example, well, it's quite difficult to read, I'm sorry about that. So if you look at the database of Palestinian Jewish names at the time, you see that Simon or Simeon were the most popular, and it was about 9% of the people at the time were called, 9% of the men at the time were called Simeon or Simon. About 8%, I think that says, were called Joseph or Joses, and so on. And you see that there's a, we can see exactly which proportion of people had those names at the time. And if you compare that with the Gospels, they occur in almost exactly the same proportions. So Simeon was the most common name at the time, and it's the most common name in the Gospels. And in both, it occurs about 10% of the time. Joseph or Joses was the second most common name at the time, and it was the second most common name in the Gospels. And again, it occurs about 8% of the time in both. There's a slight discrepancy with Lazarus. So Lazarus or Eleazar was the third most common at the time, but it's very rare in the Gospels. There's just one person called Lazarus. And this sort of guards against any suspicion that they were just doing it from an encyclopedia or a census, even if they had one. But the rest are extremely reliable and extremely kind of indicative of the actual proportion and representation of names there. And that suggests that even the minor characters that the Gospels are talking about were real people. And you can do the same with women's names. There's much less variation for women's names in first century Israel. Mary is the most common, and it was about 20 to 30% of women at the time were called Mary. So a very common name. Salome was the second most common name. And again, Mary is the name we see most in the Gospels, and Salome comes up a couple of times. Now, as well as getting the kind of proportion and distribution of names right, they also correctly represent how people were clarified or how people were identified when they had the same name. So in the modern world, we have surnames to do this, and we have a huge variety of surnames to help separate Callum Miller from Callum Best, or there aren't many Callums, to be honest, so I can't name many others. But there are a few names which are very common, and we need surnames to distinguish them. Now, in ancient times, they wouldn't do this with a normal surname. They would say, Jesus, son of Joseph, for example, or James, brother of Jesus. Or they would say, for example, Mary of Clopas, or Simon the Zealot. Sometimes it wouldn't be a family member. It would just be something that they were. Sometimes it would be their job, so Simon the Tanner. Sometimes it would be the place they were from, Jesus of Nazareth, or Joseph of Arimathea. Now, what, again, we can look at is to see whether the names in the Gospels fit what archaeology says they kind of used as surnames at the time. And again, archaeology shows us that the surnames, if you want to call them that, used in the Gospels are the surnames of the time. So the surnames of the time refer to things like their brother, their father, occasionally a female family member, but very rarely. They would speak to a political affiliation or a place that they were from or a job that they had. And these are the surnames that we see in the Gospels time and time again, represented perfectly accurately. And they use them at appropriate times. They don't go to the most uncommon name in the gospel, a name that only occurs once in the entire gospel, and give them a surname, because they don't need one. But when it comes to people like Simon or Mary, it always comes with a surname, because they know that they needed to distinguish those, because they know that there were lots of them. So again, what we have in the gospels, the names accurately match up to what we see in the archaeological records. And so we can have confidence that when the Gospels talk about the minor characters in the Gospels who aren't shown in other historical records, they're probably talking about real people. Now, so we've seen that the general outline and the general world of the New Testament is real, and we've seen that the characters are real. And given that historical fiction wasn't a genre in the first century, they didn't make up a realistic world and put fabricated or made up events in it. That gives us a good indication that the genre of the Gospels is just history. By giving a real historical place and real historical people, what the Gospel authors are saying is that this is not a myth, this is not a story, this is intended to be written as history. But we can go further and we can actually show by using non-Christian historians that the events in the life of Jesus, the main events, are ones that are corroborated and independently verified, even if you don't look at any Christian sources at all. And so I'm just going to give a few examples. There are a number of other ancient historians who write about Jesus, but even if we just stick to three, Josephus, I think Tacitus, and Pliny, we can see that actually the broad outline of Jesus's life is actually completely confirmed by history, even if you don't look at any biblical or early church documents whatsoever. I'm not going to read these out in detail, I'm just going to give a brief summary. So Josephus was a first century Jewish historian, writing at the end of the first century, and he defected to Rome during the war between the Jews and Rome. And he talks about Jesus, and this is a passage that scholars are generally agreed there are some later Christian additions to it. But often skeptics will say, scholars know that Josephus is made up, or that this passage was invented by Christians. That's not the case. Scholars agree that some parts of this passage were added by Christians later on, but they also generally agree that the large majority of the passage was written by Josephus. And so actually we can omit the things that they think were later Christian additions and still get a good knowledge of what Jesus said and did. So without those Christian additions, Josephus says, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man. He was a doer of surprising works, i.e. miracles. He taught people. He was a famous teacher. He drew together many Jews and many Gentiles. When Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, i.e. at the suggestion of the Jewish authorities, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him, i.e. Jesus' disciples, did not forsake him, for they reported that he appeared alive to them. And the tribe of Christians named after Jesus are there to this day. So he confirms the overall story of Jesus' ministry. And he also, in a separate passage that all scholars think is completely authentic, he talks about James, the brother of Jesus, and how James, the brother of Jesus, died for his faith. And in another passage separately, he talks about John the Baptist and confirms what the Bible says about John the Baptist, essentially. Second, Tacitus, we spoke about earlier when we saw that there are only two manuscripts of his famous work, The Annals of Imperial Rome. Likewise, he's probably the greatest imperial historian of Rome, writing at the beginning of the second century. And I'm not going to read through it all, but he says, Christus, i.e. the Latin name for Christ, from whom the name Christianity or Christian had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, i.e. crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And it says that the movement stopped for a moment because Jesus had died and the founder of the movement had died, and then it broke out again for some mysterious reason that Tacitus doesn't say, but which later Christians obviously said was the resurrection, or at least what they thought was a resurrection. Likewise, Pliny the Younger was a Roman governor in northern Turkey at the start of the second century, and he says quite a lot because he writes a whole letter to the Emperor Trajan that we have preserved that talks about how to punish Christians and exactly on what basis to find them guilty. So he says to Trajan, I'm finding Christians guilty, don't worry, and I'm making sure that they're tortured and forced not to be Christians. I just want to check why I'm doing this. That was what Pliny was wanting to know from Trajan. So he talks about the horrible things he was doing to Christians and says that what Christians did was that they sung hymns to Christ as to a god. And he says various other things about what Christians did, that they met on a fixed day, they ate a special meal together, they had a strict moral code and so on. But importantly, he says that the early Christians thought that Jesus essentially was a god or divine in some sense. And so taken together with various other sources, if you don't look at any Christian documents, if you don't look at the Bible at all, you can see just from secular history that Jesus was known as a moral teacher and a wise man. His followers thought he was the Messiah. He had a reputation as a miracle worker. He was condemned to death by crucifixion under the authority of Pontius Pilate at the suggestion of the Jewish chief priests during Passover. The movement that he founded stopped quickly after he died, but then broke out again in Judea, i.e. where Jerusalem was and where the resurrection was proclaimed. We know that his followers claimed that he appeared to them alive. We know that he had a brother called James who was martyred for his faith. We know that the Christian movement grew rapidly in Judea and across the Mediterranean. We know that Christians were martyred and subject to violent persecution, and that they would meet on a fixed day, we think probably Sunday, to worship together. So that's actually an immense amount that shows the fundamental Christian story about Jesus is shown to be true by history, even if you don't look at the Christian sources, even if you think the Bible is completely made up. We know that the bulk of the story is true. But actually, we can go further, and we can say even in those places where we don't have independent testimony or independent archaeology showing the Bible's truth, we can trust it. Now, why is that? That's for two main reasons. The first reason is that the Bible has been shown to be true time and time again where archaeology and where secular history does kind of interlock with it. We can look at those times where archaeology has something to say about what the Bible says, and time again, archaeology says the Bible is right. And in only a handful of possible instances does it say it's wrong or it might be wrong. The evidence there is overwhelming. So if we can trust the Bible when we can verify it, then that gives us good reason to think we can probably also trust it in those cases where biblical sources are the only sources. But even within the text of the Bible itself, we can have additional evidence that they're telling the truth. One of the reasons for this is that the Bible is not just one historical document. It's a number of historical documents that were later put together. And historians look at these sources and they say sometimes the different Gospels depend on each other. And so sometimes we don't have independent sources for the events. But, historians say, actually a lot of the time we do have independent sources for events. And as I said at the beginning, this is actually quite rare in ancient history. In most of ancient history, we have either no sources and we have no idea what happened, or we have at best one source. So if you look at, for example, some of the most famous people in first century Israel, if you look at most of the Herodian royal family outside King Herod the Great, the only documentary written source we have about almost all the Herodian royal family, who were the kings of the land in their time, for most of them, the only source that we have today is Josephus. We just have one source. And yet when it comes to most of the deeds in the Gospels, we have multiple independent sources about what Jesus said and about what Jesus did. And this is extremely compelling evidence for historians. Lots of the time, the fundamental thing that convinces historians that something happened is that there's more than one piece of evidence for it. And in the Gospels, we have that in abundance because we have often many independent sources, not even two sometimes, sometimes three or four independent sources saying that this is what Jesus said or did. And on historical grounds, that's about as certain as you can get. That's about as good evidence as you could possibly get other than an archaeological record or a video, which they didn't have at the time. One of the other things that shows the New Testament authors were telling the truth is that they fulfill what historians call the test of embarrassment. And what this means is that if you're going to make something up, if you're going to invent a story, you don't invent things that make you look bad or that raise suspicions or that make you look like you're not telling the truth. If you're making something up, you make something up to make yourself look as good as possible because that's what you're allowed to do when you can make it up. So actually, when historical sources include things that are embarrassing or that make people look bad who the people want to look good, historians think they're probably not making it up. It's probably based on reality. But this is what we find time and time again in the Gospels in a number of ways. We find that many of the male disciples in the Gospels are portrayed in very bad ways. They're portrayed as stupid, not understanding what Jesus said. They're portrayed as disloyal. They're portrayed as dishonest. Sometimes they're portrayed as betraying Jesus. In fact, the leader of the early church, Peter, was portrayed as often being hot-headed or angry, as being not understanding of what Jesus was saying, and as betraying Jesus on the final night. And this is something that you wouldn't make up if you wanted the church to look good. And so they're probably not making it up. Likewise, the crucifixion itself was immensely embarrassing, in a sense, for a movement that was based around a Messiah. Because the whole point of the Messiah was that you would have someone who came as a military leader to defeat Rome. And Jesus was the opposite. He was someone who was killed by Rome. But not only that, he was also cursed according to Jewish law. Because Jewish law said that if you hung on a cross, and this was interpreted as including crucifixion, you were cursed by God. So the Jewish mindset would have seen Jesus and thought, this is not only a failed Messiah, this is a blasphemer who was cursed by God and so hung on a cross. You would never make this up unless it actually happened, because it makes Jesus look terrible to people with that Jewish mindset. And so it's something that historians think would never have been made up by the writers of the Gospels. Likewise, when it comes to the empty tomb, and this is one of the pieces of evidence for the resurrection, the stories of the empty tomb say that it was women who found the empty tomb. Now, in the modern world, we know that women are to be believed, and that women tell the truth just as much, probably more so than men. I think most of us would concede. But in the ancient world, they didn't have that mindset. In the ancient world, they thought the testimony of women was almost worthless. They said, in fact, that at best, a woman's testimony was about half as good as a man's testimony. And in fact, the early Christians were ridiculed by their opponents, and we have writings from them. Their opponents said, "Didn't you say that the risen Jesus was seen by hysterical women?" That is how the testimony of women was treated at the time. But what this means is that if the Christians were just trying to make up a story to convince people, they never would have said that it was women who found Jesus' tomb empty and that it was women who first saw Jesus when he rose from the dead. They're saying that because although it would embarrass them in that context, obviously not in our context, although it embarrassed them in their context, they wrote it because it was true, that women really did find Jesus' tomb empty and women really did see Jesus risen from the dead. This is not something that you make up. And so we can see that even in those cases where we can't find external historical evidence outside the Bible confirming what the Bible says, and that's true for any historical source, for most of what it says you won't find confirming evidence. Even in those cases where we can't find that confirming independent verification, we can find markers within the text itself that convince historians that it's telling the truth and that it's not making things up. I'll leave the rest kind of for the Q&A if you want to talk about this anymore in the Q&A, but I'm aware we've got to have a break and have one more quick lecture on science and religion. So I'm going to leave it there for now, but there's, as you can probably see, plenty more to talk about, and I'm sure I've bored you enough already. But the point is that if the historical reliability of the New Testament can be taken seriously in this way, and all historians think that the core of the New Testament can be taken seriously historically, the only debate in academia is just how reliable they are. If the New Testament can be taken as reliable in this way, we have to take seriously what it says. And we have to take seriously what it says about what Jesus claimed about himself. We have to actually believe that the historical evidence suggests Jesus really did make these claims about himself. He really did claim to be the Messiah. He really did claim to be sent by God to establish God's kingdom. He claimed to be recreating Israel and jigging the Mosaic law and, in a sense, replacing the Mosaic law. He made all these incredible claims, and there has to be some explanation for that. But we also have to look at the evidence for Jesus' resurrection, which is in those historical narratives. And there's much more evidence that can be given for that. But the point is that this is real history, and our faith is based on real history. And when you look at it with a historian's perspective, it doesn't challenge our faith at all. In fact, it can be one of the best arguments we have for our faith. That if you look into the history and you say, God came into history because he loved us that much, that he would bring himself to our level to show us how much he loved us. That is amazing humility from God, in the sense of him coming down to our level and dying for us in a way that humiliated himself. But it's also humbling in another way of God, because it says God doesn't just come down and expect us to believe what he says without us having evidence. God comes down into a time and place that we can recognize from history and says, you can look at the evidence, you can see that I am the real deal, and you can investigate this historically to see, am I telling the truth? You can investigate me to see whether you can put your trust in me. That's immense humility from God, but it comes with an immense challenge for us. And I'm aware that I'm speaking to a church audience here, so I'm not, in a sense, I'm preaching to the choir. I'm not trying to convert any of you. I assume you're already there. But this is helpful for speaking with non-Christians, that this is a real challenge, the Jesus of history. He can't be just dismissed as someone who was crazy, because we know that he wasn't. He can't be dismissed as a liar, because we know that he wasn't. But then how do you explain what history has shown, that he made these claims about himself? And that's the question we can give to skeptics. We can say, what do you think about Jesus? You don't have to give them arguments. You don't have to try and get them onto certain other things that they might not understand. Just ask them, and this is a way of opening conversation. Say, what do you think of Jesus? And hopefully some of this historical material will just give you some background and really helpful ways to show why some of the answers they could give to that question don't make sense. They can't say Jesus didn't exist. They can't say Jesus never made these claims about himself. And if these records are reliable, they can't say that Jesus was crazy or that he was lying about who he was, because the historical records portray him as being completely sane, completely healthy, and completely honest. And so asking who Jesus is and using some of these historical resources can be a really helpful way for you to see and for you to explore that conversation and get them to give a picture of Jesus that you can gently challenge. So thank you for listening, and I'm going to let you all have a break now before we have our final talk.